Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
The World Atlas of Cheese, Episode 1. It costs $25, this particular book, by Nancy Erkoff Stork. So why do I want to listen to The World Atlas of Cheese? And if you don't want to, you can just switch it off and not listen to this podcast. This was a 1975 classic, and there's a few books which are not in the pantheon of famous authors, but I absolutely enjoy. There's another book from the early 70s that was called Home Entertaining. I picked it up at a church fete, and it was just priceless. It said, how to arrange a dinner party with music so that when your husband got really bored, you could just turn up the music. And it was just page of these very... it's all serious. It wasn't a joke. It wasn't a parody. It was all these things that when you read it, you just burst out laughing. But it wasn't a joke. It was all serious. Now, this is The World Atlas of Cheese by Nancy Erkoff Stork, a Dutch person. It's indexes cheese and cheese varieties. And it's a fantastic book by Erkoff Stork. There's a famous block of cheese here at the start, and I think you'll have to get into it, because when you listen to it, it's a book that when I picked it up, I couldn't put it down, because it discussed all theories, all things to do with cheese, then the different varieties of cheese, and then the assessment. It's a world atlas. It's an atlas of cheese. So every country, it gets graded by the quality of cheese it produces. So it's all geography, but all history to do with cheese. So all mythology. And then there's cheese technology, which no longer exists, but they're all really super fascinating to listen to. So here's the introduction. I think she's written it. And we'll get to know her a bit better. Cheese is one of our most basic, nourishing, and flavorful foods. Oh, there you go. It's just really added. It's found in nearly every part of the world, not only in quantity, but enormous variety. There is reindeer cheese in Lapland and yak's milk cheese in Nepal, to a long list of international favorites such as cheddar, brie, gouda, gorgonzola, roquefort, feta, and parmesan. Cheese is very much the product of a given land and its people. Indeed, the entire range of the world's cheeses is due not only to man's inventiveness, but a host of other factors that make up the environment he lives in. Climate, soil, vegetation, altitude, sort of the areas, economic development, the kind of milk-producing animals available, and even national taste and customs. Now, this broad sweep, what a fantastic... thing. The making of cheese is a domestic skill that became an art. An art became an industry. Cheese, this is fantastic. You know, this, she could give it an address to the United Nations and so on. Most of the prominent national cheese types have gradually evolved from traditional farmhouse methods. Successful combination of art and industry has resulted in the manufacture of durable, high-quality cheeses capable of being produced in large scale and transported over long distances without much loss of original character. Yet, there remains hundreds, perhaps thousands, of small rural types that never reach the big markets. Cheese that have been made made for centuries. In secluded remote valleys or high alpine meadows. Cheese as an everyday item means different things to different people. In Provence, in the south of France, it's probably a small white goat's milk cheese wrapped in a chestnut leaves called Banon, delicious with a glass of rosé. In Somerset, England, it's likely to be cheddar, eaten with bread and a glass of beer. In the United States, it may also be cheddar, but cheddar from Wisconsin, to be enjoyed by with a New York and California wine. In Denmark, the choices from Samso in Holland, Gouda, Ouida, Mexico, Queso Fresco, flavoured perhaps with a sprinkle of chili powder. With the growing number of gourmet cheeses shops springing up in many areas, it's possible to sample both staple and gourmet varieties from all over the world. The World Atlas of Cheese sets out to explore the world of cheese in its entirety. Like the World Atlas of Cheese setting out to explore the World Atlas of Cheese, the world of cheese. In the country by country survey that forms the major part of this atlas, virtually all cheeses, from the most familiar to the most obscure, are described in their natural national context. How the climate and geography of the area affects the local dairy industry. How the various national cheeses originated. How they are made, packaged and sold. How they taste, look and smell. How they can be enjoyed. In addition, data panels for the most of the countries provide vital information on specific cheeses. Their weight, consistency, rind formation, fat content, etc. The text is supplemented by an abundance of drawings and photographs, plus a series of cheese maps and production of diagrams detailing the manufacturing of several major cheese types: Emmental, cheddar, Gouda, Camembert, and cottage cheese. We've also provided special sections at the beginning and end of the book, which deal with the more practical aspects of the world of cheese. Particularly helpful are the sections entitled Cheese in Your Home and Cheese and Why, where detailed information is given about preparing cheese boards, hosting cheese and wine parties, and selecting complimentary cheeses and wines. Cooks should be especially enjoy the recipe section, which is more than 45 international cheese dishes. For the more daring, there's a section entitled Make Your Own Cheese. A general overview of the history of cheese and cheese making from the earliest time and modern milking techniques and milk preparation. And the nutritional value of cheese can be found in the opening sections. The popularity of cheese in the world's larder is growing at a remarkable rate. With this in mind, the World Atlas of Cheese is dedicated to cheese lovers everywhere and hopes that it will widen their horizons, whet their appetites, W-H-E-T, their appetites, and add to their enjoyments of one of the world's most basic and sumptuous foods. It's beautiful there. I'm just really thinking there was, in my mind, there's a beautiful composition. I've got to really practice rather than actually just appreciate. History of cheese and cheese making. This panel. A beautiful Assyrian relief from the palace of Sennacherib showing a man with a herd of cattle. History of cheese only become fascinating and understandable when viewed against the history of mammals and its milk. A history reaching back before man. Mammals live wild, multiplied and suckle their young, fighting a battle of life and death with other animals and with nature itself. Man came and killed them for their meat. Later, he recognized the advantages of taming and domesticating them and relied on them for many purposes. Domestic animals helped with the heavy work. They produced dung as fertilizer for fuel. When necessary, the animals could be slaughtered and eaten. They bred in captivity. They gave milk. This all happened many thousands of years before the Christian era. Where and when man started milking and making cheese for the first time is a supposition based on archaeological discoveries. Okay, there's a picture here. Early milking. Up to now, the oldest pictorial evidence comes from the Mesopotamians. This beautiful release on Ulbad and stamp seal from Jessamine Nasir era show how the Sumerians milked their cattle and handle the milk. In Egypt, in the tomb of Horus Ha, second king of the first dynasty, pots were found with what chemical analysis has virtually proved to be the remains of cheese. Cheese is mentioned in hieroglyphic texts. Oh. new psychological discoveries have been made in Africa. Cave paintings, the Liberian Sahara, very like those in Spain and France, show what appears to be milk processing, and dated from the period of 5500 to 2000 BC. The origins of the Saharan tribes is still an open question. Did they already live here in prehistoric times? Did they tame their animals and learn to use their milk? Or was Asia the original homeland? And did they come to Africa as nomad shepherds, bringing with them their knowledge of milking? Sahara was certainly not as arid in those days. There was a different path, there was sufficient pasture for cows, sheep and goats. But, unfortunately, after the period around 2500 BC, nothing more has been found to shed further light on how these tribes lived. Was their herdsman's existence no longer possible then? Were they forced to look for new grazing lands? These facts are not known. The continual movement of tribes looking for better living conditions was usually and often assumed to be a proportion of large-scale migrations. Indo-European peoples probably came from the Asian steppes to the Dnieper Valley and then spread from around 3000 to 2000 BC, further over the Balkans, Northern Europe and Asia. It is possible that the Indo-Europeans introduced their knowledge of cheese to Europe, or the tribes already knew about it earlier. The Basque, for example, perhaps the only pre-Indo-European race left on the continent, already had words for cheese and whey. In the southern Eastern Europe, indications have been found that seem to strengthen the hypothesis that the milking in Macedonia and Thessaly first took place in 6500 to 5000 BC. Thus, the earliest history of milking and cheese making is shrouded in unsolved mysteries. The answers may never be revealed. However, this may be, it is certain that the perforated pots dating from the Bronze Age, 3000 to 1000 BC, were used for making cheese. The classical writers supply ample evidence of the fact that the Greeks and Roman empires were at the height in their glory. Cheese was a well-known, a popular daily food, and certainly nothing new. From the sources we know, throughout the Roman occupied territories, the preparation of cheese was being perfected. As for Asia, it is known that the cattle were kept in the Indus Valley, but no pictures have been found of actual milking. The mammals that are represented have small udders and are likely to have been used for milk. The first references to milking date from the period after the arrival of Indo-European settlers from the upper reaches of the Indus, who were accustomed to drinking milk and eating cheese. Later they moved to the Ganges Valley, where they influenced tribes who knew nothing about milking. Asia, however, has never become a great dairy region, partly because the Hindu and Buddhist religions consider the cow a sacred animal. Using the milk and dairy produce as offerings, dairy produce has never been a day-to-day food in this area. Some like it. Over the whole world, there have remained areas where no milking cattle are kept and where no milking is done for very different reasons. Some people have always thought it morally wrong to withhold milk from animals' own young. Many had religious objections. Others did not like the smell and taste of milk, refusing to touch it if they could help it. The food value of milk was not always appreciated by those who who had other sources of proteins, such as fat, especially meat. Lastly, in areas that worked very intensely for certain crops, farmers could not afford to keep more cattle than absolutely necessary, and then only as draft animals. The Chinese, for instance, concentrated on rice growing and regarded milk as nothing but a sickly secretion unfit for human consumption. Over the centuries, the borders vanishing between the areas where milk was used and it was not. Migration of peoples and foreign influences paved the way for hitherto unknown products like milk and cheese. There was only one large landmass, the Americas, where milk and cheese remained absolutely unknown until the Europeans arrived. Like, oh well, Australia doesn't get a mention there. Cheese and cheese making. How cheese was prepared cannot be established archaeologically. Neither can the equipment used, but we may assume that all over the world, wherever milking was discovered, the art of cheese making was learned very soon after. Originally, this is likely to have been sour milk cheese. Everywhere, milk will spontaneously turn sour, especially in hot countries and in those with a moderate climate. And the increased acidity will curdle the milk, separating it into flocculated proteins. So let's do. Milk is this amazing product where you've got all these different chemicals and you have rennin or casein, which is a protein which essentially interacts with the surface membrane of fat globules and keeps them suspended. It makes this a repulsion. So if you put some milk in, it will actually move much faster, separate much faster than, say, if you put dye. So if you put a drop of milk in water, it will spread out really quickly. If you put a drop of food dye, it will just stay together. That's an interesting experiment to do. Will curdle milk, separating into flocculated proteins, fat and fluid whey. So flocculated, that's interesting. So the fat film, the fat will float, the proteins will drop down and fluid whey. This must have happened countless of times and is a small step to pour the thickened mass of into plaited baskets or in perforated pots. The remaining fluid could thus be removed with a sort of fresh acid curd cheese was achieved. Method varied from country to country. The rough gourd in which some cheese makers sour their milk gave it a special flavour, as did the wicker basket and others used. The casks used by the Mongols were never cleaned, so the remaining bacteria soured the milk quicker. Oh, there you go. Discovery of rennet. So rennet is a protein which, an enzyme which attacks casein. Let's see what they say. The curdling of milk with rennet, a curdling agent prepared from the stomachs of animals, must be credited to the luck more than to Astritus, Bacchus, or Pan. These are the gods. According to Greek mythology, the gods of Olympus decided to make the lucky mortals a gift of everlasting value by teaching them the art of making cheese. Of course, there is probably some truth in the story of the Arab who passed through the desert with a caravan and found that the milk he was carrying with him contained in the dried sheep stomachs had been curdled better and quicker than ever before. Herdsmen have always animal skins handy in which milk can be kept. After slaughtering his young cattle, primitive man may have examined the stomachs especially and partly digested milk, which had led further experiments. The next step would be hang a strip of land stomach or any other still suckling animal in milk, just to see what happened. In such a way, with a little luck, the curdling power of the animal rennet has been discovered. Even nowadays, the chemistry and technology, no better substitute for this natural rennet material has been found. Other cheese makers discovered the curdling properties of certain plants or vegetables juices in the same accidental way. Removal of most of the moisture makes cheese firmer and improves the keeping quality, particularly when it's pressed dried in the sun. So your fat molecules, protein molecules, are repelled from each other. So like they're all covered with north, they're all charged or polarized from each other, and rennet knocks out the casein, which is a particular thing. Okay. Particularly when pressed, dried in the sun, and salted. So this is to make it, on the way to making it, not fit for bacteria to go. This proved to be a very welcome development for the wandering nomads as well as the cheese traders. The great discoveries were now made, although the chemical and physical principles upon which they rested remained unknown. Individual recipes and working methods evolved invariably on trial and error basis, and their successes are determined by many variables. Milk, rennet, temperature, acidity, curd, quality, degree of salt, pressure, knowledge was handed down from father to son, mother to daughter, people to people. At the beginning of our era, in the markets of Rome, countless different cheese types were sold, either soft, fresh, hard cheese prepared with milk from cows, sheep, goats. Julius Caesar wrote that the Germans... of the Germans, that their food was the greater part consisted of milk, cheese and meat. In numerous European countries, cheese was being made and marketed outside their own borders. After the fall of the Roman Empire and the decline of civilization, the history and development of cheese suffered a long period of obscurity. Isn't it beautiful? Isn't it beautiful? They're discussing cheese. The new beginning. With the spread of Christianity, monasteries were founded throughout Western world. Monastic orders, apart from their religious missions, set themselves additional tasks. In the early Middle Ages, they were almost the only centres of cultural enterprise. They also cultivated the fields, nursed sick people, lodged pilgrims, looked after the cattle, and made cheese, of course. I can't look after you, I've got to make some cheese. It was the monks who gave European cheesemaking a new start by passing their precious experience and knowledge to others. Famous cheese varieties such as the ancestors of today, Port Salut, came from their monasteries. Following the reign of Charlemagne, 742 to 814, the great advances were made in all fields. A new stimulus appeared that greatly influenced the history of cheese. The Viking trade. Viking expeditions started as trading expeditions, but degenerated too often to plundering invasions. Expeditions under Knut the Great, 1016, brought the knowledge of Scandinavian cheesemaking to the Baltic countries, to England, Normandy and the areas of the Volga and Black Sea, and to Byzantium. They re-established the forgotten trade contacts in North and Southern Europe, and founded a trading post in Novgorod, Kiev, and demonstrated the advantage of sea trading. The Crusades, 1096 to 1270, also had the influence. Contacts between the superior Byzantine and Arab culture brought a new outlook. Cheese was among the first things affected by the resulting cultural revaluation. And the Crusaders, who had a taste of interesting foreign varieties. At the time, international trading and exchange were very much strengthened, so that cheese recipes and cheesemaking methods no doubt found their way to foreign regions, thus giving trade a welcome impetus. In the 11th century, Byzantium reached its height of prosperity. Yes, okay. But after its downfall, commerce shifted to Venice. Italian markets became centres of the world trade and traffic between East and West. Venetian ships carried on a lucrative business. Dutch merchants became ship owners, specialising in freight, which they later completely dominated the Mediterranean. In all respects, life and prosperity of medieval towns depended on foreign trade. German merchant towns founded the Hanseatic League and developed into a mighty commercial states, sailing the seas in all directions with their ever bigger and faster merchant ships, armed against pirates and competitors. World trade spread out over the North Sea, Baltic Sea, the Mediterranean and the Atlantic. The age of discovery began and the new world was colonized. I love this sweeping edge, it's all on the edge of cheese. Asia, especially Eastern India, proved a treasure house for the greedy Europeans. People moved from country to country, and from continent to continent, and from settling of experienced cheesemakers into the countries meant the introduction of new varieties. Large cities in many countries held regular markets and fairs, which were visited by foreign traders with their products. The guilds came into being for their famous guild halls and the trade centres of northern France, England and Netherlands. With the growth of the cities, the need for good cheese and general food increased enormously. Since it was one of the accepted international commercial products, every cheese a producing country aimed at increased production, even if it was not enough to meet home demand, yet they were spurred by the possibility of selling abroad, and the foreign varieties might be more attractive than the home variety. As far as cheese preparation methods are concerned, an important difference sprang up between those countries having good cattle and pastures, and also sea and river ports, essential for successful exports, and those countries where production was battling against unfavorable circumstances. The first had to make cheese that was easily transportable cheese, whose quality was not affected by travel, and that would be resistant to the changing weather conditions and temperatures. The others stuck to the same old method, making their attractive but perishable cheeses to be sold in immediate surroundings. For the Dutch Edam cheese, for instance, in demand all over the world, the cheesecloth was supplied early on a well-closed run under the process. Cheeses were treated with extra care and primitive cheese presses were replaced by heavier ones able to apply pressure more evenly, which again improved the quality and the end of the end product. Transportation and storage had to be done according to precise prescriptions, yet cheeses were not always of satisfactory quality, and the various quality variations were great. The adulteration of foodstuff was commonplace in the days before official regulations and controls were instituted. To reach high quality standards, the cheesemaker needed great experience, feeling and love for his craft. Cheesemaking was to remain an art rather than a science or technical process until the 20th century. Sudden modernization. It seems as if cheesemaking hardly changed during the last 8 to 10 centuries. Tried all at once to make up the leeway and become ultra-modern industry. A series of exciting discoveries in the bacteriological, chemical and technical fields set off a rapid modernization. The great German chemist and agriculturalist Justus von Liebig had already determined in 1836 that the formation of cheese could be explained in purely scientific terms. 20 years later, Louis Pasteur, working in a brewery in the town of Lille, discovered the microorganism brought about the fermentation process in beer. He applied his theory to lactic formation and also formation of wine, showing how he could heat and destroy the organisms, thus slowing down the biochemical process. In 1876, he published his findings recommending that milk be heated in order to destroy the harmful bacterium, and at the same time delaying the development of useful bacterium. Pasteur's research was primarily concerned with the fermentation of beer and wine. His co-author, the biologist Ilya Mechnikov, occupied himself with milk as a bacterium. Their fermentation and pasteurization of milk. Soon the pasteurization process became widely adopted. Pasteur also distinguished two types of bacteria, anaerobic, those that do not need air for multiplications, and aerobic, who do need air. He showed that certain forms of bacteria can form highly resistant spores, the finding that was confirmed by physicist John Tyndall. Oh wow! He discovered that the spores were almost totally resistant to heat. Now, this is one of the things I have to really, really understand. John Tyndall, he's a physicist I want to know more about. Following the great advances made in the field of biochemistry, pure starter cultures and standardized remnants were prepared in laboratories. The mysteries of ripening processes and complex actions of taste and aroma-forming bacteria were gradually unraveled. These discoveries and many others were bound to follow and gave the dairy industry the scientific backing that it needed. Not only could production be well established, of well established cheese be improved, but uniform quality and excellence were almost guaranteed. Furthermore, the laboratory experiments led to the development of entirely new cheese types. At the same time, the 19th century was the age of industry and invention. Cheesemaking was not a traditional craft to challenge almost beyond recognition when influenced by technological progress. The small cooperative private enterprises had simple beginnings. They were equipped with steam engines to provide heat to drive the machinery, but the basic cheesemaker skills were unchanged. These early factories have not now given way to ultra-modern mammoth industries, where cheese is made from milk in one continuous process, fully automated and controlled not by skilled cheesemakers, but by operators. Thanks to specialized research carried out by scientific institutions and industry, the quality of cheese made in these production units is uniform and quite high quality, even though it may lack the individual charm of farmhouse cheese. The interesting thing is that farmhouse cheese, produced and marketed on small scales, has not been eradicated by industrialized cheesemaking. Factory cheese needed to cope with a rising demand. Farmhouse cheese has remained in existence because its quality, its uniqueness and individualities has always been prized and recognized by gourmets everywhere. Farmhouse cheese has surely profited from research and technological improvements as well, and it is every bit as good, maybe better, than the same cheese produced 100 years ago. It's bound to keep its own pace in cheese assortments of most countries. Okay, that's my first thing, The World Atlas of Cheese, Episode 1. The next chapter is milking cattle and other things. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.